All right. It looks like we're, I know some folks are still joining, but it looks like we've got quite a few on, and we have a full and busy morning. So I'll go ahead and get started with a few housekeeping notes. So we have a presentation today. You're going to hear from Myron Steves, who is our chancellor for C4SO, and then I'll be sharing with you and representing the work of a whole team of people who are on the phone today. So as we go on, our platform Zoom is new. We love it, and if you need one, we would highly recommend Zoom for you guys. But it is new, so if you have problems, use the chat pod. Any technical problems, Ryan will be on chat, and he'll he can help with those technical issues, and then Sheila is here. Sheila Jackson, of course, everybody knows her and loves her. And Sheila's going to be managing this program. She's been the driver behind it. And so she will be on the chat pod, too, to answer any questions. So just you guys are all muted, but you can type those questions in the chat pod. We'll be keeping an eye on it. And some of those questions we'll answer live in the presentation. Some we'll answer at the end of the presentation, and some Sheila will handle in chat pod. We'll just work on it that way, and she'll be monitoring it. We are going to record this session and use it for hopefully for a podcast, because we know that there's a lot of information being conveyed today, and so it will be recorded. All of you will have a link to the video and hopefully to the podcast as well. All right. With that, we'll go ahead and get started. So thank you, everyone, for joining us today. None of us wants to be here talking about this. We wish that, when we have this time to come together and participate, that we were talking about much more edifying topics. This is, whenever we're talking about programs, I use that. I often have to work on programs, and I know that they are a hassle. It's not anything we want to do. And in this one in particular, it sort of sickens us to think that we're even having to talk about this topic. It's so far from where we want things to be. But we know the people around us, and we look at them and we think, this could not happen at my church. For most church plants, we're all just so happy to be together and to have found each other and to be starting something new, that it's just hard to believe that anything like this could happen. But anybody that's been in ministry in any length of time can tell you just about anything can happen. And we know that this has happened in the past, and it can happen again. And Myron, our chancellor, our legal advisor, is here to help us understand the reality of the situation and help us to face that. And as clergy and church leaders, we have a spiritual mandate. It's not just the responsibility of any business owner. We have a spiritual mandate to protect the children in our midst. We're called to establish a secure environment for them so that they can understand the perfect love of God that works to cast out all fear and to create a safe environment to train up these children in the way they should go. So today we'll be sharing our new child protection program. It's been developed with the help of our legal counsel and experienced church leaders. We've talked a lot with the folks at Redemption, at Christ Church, Overland Park, and at Christ Church Plano to understand the differences between what a church plant is going through and what big churches are going through. And we've gotten the best advice that we could get to start this program. We've tried to balance care for our children with practicality. We know that each one of you has a lot of work to do, a lot of things on your plate. Some of our churches have significant resources, but most do not. And so we've tried to balance that care and due diligence with practicality. So hopefully this program will be as easy as possible to implement and effective in its protection for the most vulnerable in our midst. We know that many of you have programs in place. The reality is we're talking to you in early September, and we know a lot of you have been training in the last month to get your folks ready for back to school. So And some of you got material from your insurance carriers that says, here are the requirements they expect of you. So we understand that you have realities already in place. Please know that this is meant to be a baseline. Hopefully, if you've already been doing training or you've been working with your insurance carrier, it's likely that the things that we're talking about today are similar to those efforts. And so hopefully they shouldn't be additive to what you've already done. Hopefully they're already incorporated to a large degree. But it's important to note that what we're calling for is just a baseline. Your insurance carrier or your state may require more than we're asking for, because we've tried to keep ours fairly simplistic as much as we can, as streamlined as we can. So it's possible that you have additional requirements, or that if you're a church, for instance, that has a school, or a church that is close to water, or a church that's in a very public urban setting, you could have additional requirements on top of what we are stating. So it's important for you to look at this program as your starting point and then say, in addition to this, what else might I need? And that'll make more sense as we go through the specifics of the program. The last thing I would say is that if you have specific situations, or if we find as we work through this, and you know it's new, this is year one, so it's possible that we could find things that need to be adjusted. We're going to work with you guys on that. Don't feel like, you know, this is being handed down and this is the way it will be forever. If there are good reasons why we need to make a change to this program, we absolutely will. And we'll work with you in year one to get it really solid. And then our goal is that each year we are meeting again with any changes, with any updates, any improvements in the summer timeframe, so that you guys are better prepared going into next year. All right. With that, I just realized I need to share. All right, great. With that, I will turn it over to Myron Steves. Myron, we have been so blessed to work with Myron. He's a leader in working with churches and nonprofits. He works with clients all over the U.S. He's a professor and the former dean of Trinity Law School in Southern California, and he's been a big support, not just for us, but for many ACNA churches. He works with the ACNA, is on the Council for Chancellors, and so he's been a tremendous resource for us and is passionate about this field and equipping us for this ministry. So thank you so much, Myron, for all that you've done and for being here this morning. Myron, we can't hear you. If you look at your Zoom menu, you may be muted.
Okay. There, can you hear me? All right.
Yep, we got you.
Great. Well, it's a pleasure to be talking to you today. I know this is a sensitive and grave subject, but this is an opportunity to work together on looking out for the best interest of the children that we minister to. I wanted to start off by giving a little bit of my background in this area. Many years ago, when the mandatory sex offender reporting program went on the internet, it created a lot of difficulties across the country, state by state, in that there were errors in who was put on the internet. And for a couple of years, I helped process several thousand people that went on the online notice. And I handled about 200 of those individuals along the way and got to know a lot of sex offenders and got to see a lot of the common traits. And it's very interesting. I think you can divide them in a couple of categories. The majority of them were ones who were so damaged by their own sexual experience as youth, that you got the sense when talking to them that something was not quite right with them. And this is a group that is hurting and needs to be ministered to. And certainly part of church ministry is figuring out how do you balance ministering to those in need with the fact that you've got children and youth in a close community in a church setting. But an area to be cautious about is the kind of people that inhabit that world of sexual predators. They dedicate a great deal of time and energy to carrying out their activities, and they are in contact with each other. And because they think about these issues constantly and we don't, they can easily outsmart the unwitting. For example, when you do reference checks and background checks on people working within the church, it's very easy for a sex offender to get very good references from other sex offenders. And you need to be cautious about assuming goodwill on the part of those that submit to a background check. And similarly, we do recommend that you not allow people to be involved in children's ministry until they've been a part of the congregational life for a while. But realize that a part of this is something that is expected by the sex offender. And some of them are actually enticed by the waiting period, and it has a seductive effect on them. So we always need to be cautious about the possibility of people doing an end run around our emotions in trying to get at a welcoming community that has children and youth available. On the other end of the spectrum, there are a number of people, a large minority, that lead very normal lives and are well integrated into life and society, except for the fact that they were horribly abused as children. And as much as that experience defines what they don't want to be as adults, they have a very hard time breaking out of perpetuating that horrific behavior. And when you encounter these people, they are completely well adjusted in every way that is evident to outsiders. They have careers with a good background. They're dependable, and generally they can keep their sexual activity in check, except it's situational, where given the right set of circumstances, such as extended period of time alone with children, where they're in an environment where they're expected to nurture, it can trigger habits and deep, dark memories that are very hard for them to overcome. So we shouldn't be seduced into thinking that you can pick out a sex offender just by conversation. Many of these people have compartmentalized their lives and appear well-adjusted most of the time, but certain activities, which happen to be the kinds of activities you see in churches, can trigger things that are difficult for them to control. That leads into the reason why we've got this complex manual system to train all volunteers to know not just what to identify in other people, but how to manage the oversight of children's activities in a way that situations that leave the vulnerable susceptible to predatory activity just don't get much of an opportunity. I also want to talk a little bit about the insurance aspect of this. Most states have laws that protect volunteers for nonprofit organizations, including churches. So if you volunteer and are engaged in a negligent activity, the law will protect you for the most part in most states. However, that protection does not extend to every negligent act. The statutes generally exclude gross negligence. And gross negligence is a failure to follow the due care required, but to do so in such an extraordinarily reckless or careless manner that it creates a different kind of liability. And unfortunately, gross negligence has been interpreted as including churches that treat the protection of children and youth in a cavalier and casual manner. So there's not complete protection, but if a church has a means of protecting children in place and exercises great efforts to follow it, the likelihood of gross negligence being found can be minimized substantially. So we are approaching this by a program that takes several approaches on how to protect children. And if followed, it can do a very good job of preventing the kinds of situations that give rise to sexual predators acting. And you'll hear an explanation of this further along, but the materials are divided into a manual that is designed for the average volunteer. It can be read quickly and can be understood before one begins working with children and youth. And then there's a more complex manual that is designed for people like those who've participated in this webinar that provide greater details. It is relatively easy to adopt a policy. It is also nearly as easy when adopting it to get everybody involved in working with youth to go through the training. The biggest battle in this area of child protection is what happens 3 or 4 months after the policy has been adopted. The challenge is, how do we assure that every congregation is dedicated to developing a culture of protection of children? Developing that culture means necessarily that every time a new volunteer comes on board, they get adequate screening and training, rather than a decision being made that will, for the sake of efficiency, handle training just once a year, and by that letting some volunteers in who have not been screened and trained. It involves constant vigilance to make sure that there are no loose ends anywhere, that there are no Sunday school classrooms with no windows where individuals are left alone with children. This kind of vigilance requires church leadership at the highest level to care passionately about making sure that this problem is addressed all the time. There's much in our nature that doesn't like this. We prefer to think of our ministry with children in positive light rather than thinking about protection from horrific situations that go wrong. But maintaining and sustaining a culture is an important part of this kind of ministry. And I am happy to report that the diocese is doing a great job at the top leadership level of the diocese to make sure that this information remains in the forefront of the minds of everyone that works with children and youth. And in our individual congregations, the most critical thing is to sustain this culture of caution and care throughout all the activities that we do. And with that, by way of introduction, I think, Kimberly, we can go on to looking through the materials that have been prepared for the day.
Scared the bejesus out of me early in this early in our relationship by pointing out the reality of the problem of gross negligence, and that right now all of us who are working within the church are covered under insurance policies. We have liability that protects us if things go wrong, but in the case of gross negligence, it's possible that your insurance coverage would not cover you and that you would be personally liable for problems that happen. And so on top of our spiritual requirement and our call to take care of these kids, there's a real personal importance for everyone on this phone to make sure that you're adhering to these policies and doing your utmost so that if something does go wrong, that you're not personally liable. All right, so with that, there we go, letting me advance. All right, as Myron mentioned, we've been working on this program to have a comprehensive part of it, and some of you have seen bits and pieces of this over the last few months, because we didn't wait until the full program was in place to get started. So those of you who've been working with us to get the ministry safe infrastructure in place and get all your staff and volunteers up to speed on ministry safe, you're already ahead of the game. And we thank you. We thank you for that. We're hoping that the work that we've done along with the Diocese of the Mid-Atlantic and some of the others that Myron has been working with, we're hoping that this will provide a solid foundation for the ACNA, because this is going to be one of their provincial efforts this year as well. So hopefully this puts us ahead of the game and can be work that will benefit the province as well. So basically there are five components to the program that helps us protect children from harm. The first is in screening, making sure that all of the people that are on your staff, that are working in your church, that are your volunteers, they've all been screened to identify anyone who in the past has had a problem with child abuse or neglect. And so when you read through the manual, I'm not going to go through each one of these and all of the requirements and talk you through them, because all of the details are outlined in the manual. But most of you have in place already some screening forms, and we'll let you know what those should be. So it involves going back and making sure that they haven't had criminal activity in their past, that they haven't been convicted of any wrongdoing, that there haven't been any reports of that, and making sure that our children are protected from people who have already exhibited the behavior from which we're trying to protect them. Then there's the training. So making sure, and this is the part where Ministry Safe is an important component, making sure that people are trained to identify these people. As Myron pointed out, they spend an enormous amount of time planning, hiding, making sure that they are undercover. And unless you are in a position to recognize those behaviors, you won't be able to prevent them from happening. So this training helps us to recognize our blind spots, what we would think of as normal behavior, or we might not recognize as unusual. Being trained to identify those things helps us to be prepared. Then looking at the ways that we're interacting with children, as Myron pointed out, making sure that classrooms are visible, that there's never a time when children are alone, you're looking at bathroom behavior, things like that, the way that we interact with children. We go through a long list of those things, and those are really just thought starters for you guys. They're guidelines that we've thought of, but the important thing is to read through those and say, what are the ways in which, in my particular church, with my particular congregation, that I need to apply this thinking? Take a look at those, go through them, work with them with your team, and look at your processes. It's going to be, it's not just a box to check off. It's a mindset and a way of viewing the way that your church works. Then monitoring and making sure that things are working and things are under control. And then unfortunately, looking at the ways to respond and report when incidents happen. We need to be prepared and be in the mindset that at some point something will go wrong and there will be an incident. And when that happens, if responses are strong, if the way that the church reacts to the problem is strong, then the damage from that incident will be mitigated. And so we want to make sure that everyone is thinking about what ifs and contingency planning, so that if something goes wrong, the church is helpful in that process, not contributing to the problem. So as you go through, there are two documents that you'll see on our website. One is our manual, our Child Protection Policy Manual. That has all of this information and all of the detail. Then the accompanying document for that is an implementation guide that tells you how, as you're reading those manual, how you would implement those things locally. And so all of the detail is included in those two documents, and we encourage you to spend a fair amount of time with your staff going through those. We'll give you the website for that as well, but it's c4so.org/children. So the important part of this, one of the important parts of this program is that this isn't a top-down program. As you read through these materials and resources, they're meant for you to have what you need to drive this program locally. You know, if we were a geographic diocese and we had a few churches in a relatively small geographic area, maybe it would be possible for us to go and monitor each church and that sort of thing. We don't have that kind of structure. And honestly, that kind of monitoring doesn't work because people are too far removed outside of your church to make sure that this goes well. So it's important to know that your key leadership is responsible for making sure they take the materials and the resources that we're providing and implement them, that they're passionate, as Myron said, that they're passionate about the importance of this and that they are vigilant in making sure that it's top of mind all the time with children. That doesn't just mean the rector, although the rector is the most important person in this process, for setting the leadership and the vision to make sure that this is top of mind. But the senior warden is also critical in this process because there are things that the rector is going to need help with the vestry and with the congregation. He needs a partner to make sure she or she needs a partner to make sure that that they have what they need in order to make this work. It's not possible for one person to simply drive this, but if the rector and the senior warden are united in this vision, then they can help push this through the congregation. Hopefully, many of you will also be blessed to have a coordinator in your congregation as well, whether that's a staff member, a program administrator, or a volunteer. In some cases, it may be a volunteer. It will be very helpful to you if you can find someone in your church to help run this program. It should not take a lot of time, especially in a small church, but it does require that someone is expert in the specifics of the program. And so I know for some church plants that's going to need to be the rector, but we would encourage you very quickly to identify someone who can be responsible for this for you. And we'll go through the specifics on that so you'll get a sense of the workload and scale. As I said, for a small church, it should not be too onerous, but for a large church, it would be a significant amount of time. The other important thing about local requirements is that everything that we're telling you is sort of the baseline across the states in which we operate, but each state is different. And unfortunately, we can't do that for you. You've got to be responsible for your state requirements. And if you're in a state like California, for example, those requirements could be pretty intense. So it's important that you familiarize yourself with those requirements. We have some of them posted on our website. We've given reporting requirements by state, so you'll be able to see those. And your insurance carrier will be very helpful for helping you interpret those locally as well. From a diocesan standpoint, I always smile because I put Sheila under the resources, and she is an incredible resource for us here at C4SO, but she's driving this program, so she is the resident expert in this program. And we've created, with the help of Andrea and Ryan, the c4so.org/children website, which should provide most of the resources that you need if you're as you're getting started. Okay, so what comes next? Within the next 2 weeks, we'd like for you guys, the rector, the senior warden, and a coordinator in your congregation to read the policy manual. We've really worked hard to make it as simple to read as we can, and as clear and hopefully not too difficult. But it is important to read it. We've left only the information there that we felt was really important for you. So it is important that you guys read it and then return a signed copy of the acknowledgement of receipt. Myron pointed out, and I would share with the group, that the acknowledgement of receipt form, which is the back page of the manual, basically you could just sign that. But signing it is not not what's important here. We didn't develop this program so that we could check boxes off. We've designed this program so that we are equipped to do the work of protecting our children. So if you read the manual and something is confusing, please let us know, especially because if you have a question, someone else has a question, and they may not be as brave at asking. So please let us know if anything in those manuals is not clear. Then we need you to provide us the contact information for your coordinator, whoever it's going to be. If you're a church plant with no volunteers and no staff, it may be the rector. But hopefully that'll be someone else on your team who can give you a hand, a volunteer, or someone that you can have responsible. We'll be adding everyone who's identified as a coordinator to a closed Facebook group. And that way they can ask open questions. Sheila will have a clear way to communicate as resources become available. And we'll keep everybody in the loop. I think that's going to be an important way to build community in our diocese, and also to make sure that shared learning takes place. As people encounter issues, as they are working through implementation, they can share their knowledge and get everybody up to speed much more quickly. Additionally, the rector and your staff need to develop a reporting plan. I mentioned earlier the importance of responding well and the opportunity that the church has when a crisis like this happens to bring about healing, to represent the kingdom and redeem a situation that will seem nearly impossible to redeem. Reacting well can make the difference between spiritual health and a long-term wound from the church. So it's important that you guys develop a reporting plan for your congregation. For instance, making sure that everyone knows who to escalate to first. And normally we're going to recommend that be your coordinator. When the coordinator has something come to them, they need to know who to call first. And then that person needs to know to call the diocese. So those sorts of things need to be outlined. They need to be discussed. And because the people that deal with this when it happens are going to be under enormous emotional pressure. And so relying on their judgment in the moment is not a safe approach. So we want to make sure that all of the individual decisions are taken out of it and that everybody knows how it's going to be handled. And that's for you internally. We don't check those. You're not submitting those to us. But we can tell you from a diocesan perspective that we're in places where we have outlined response steps ahead of time, our response has been much more professional and pastoral. And so we highly commend this to you. So once you've done those things, work with your staff then, and you will see in the manual the business about interacting and monitoring. Go through your programs, your facilities. Think about your culture. Think about the people in your congregation. And apply those learnings from interaction and monitoring to your situation. I'll go back to that, to Myron's example of a classroom with no windows in it. A lot of us are in buildings that we didn't choose, that we're trying to work within. And so in some cases, we've made decisions or we've agreed to trade-offs that have just been practical. But in reality, you're going to have to assess those risks and find ways around them. So for instance, if your children are in a classroom with no windows, then leaving a single adult is not appropriate. You need to have multiple adults in the room. You have to assess your bathroom situation and things like that. That's a process that needs to be gone through and then needs to be ongoing. I would strongly commend you to do regular meetings to discuss it in the first year as you're making the change with your staff and bringing them into a culture of vigilance, scheduling regular discussions and making it a topic on a regular basis will help them to change their way of thinking and keep it top of mind. Then ministry safe training. Like I said, most of you have made significant progress, and I'm very appreciative of all of the work that's happened there. I know that it's been a heavy lift for churches who weren't going through this in the past. I was very heartened by some of the feedback that we've received from congregations about how much they learned, how they didn't realize the risk, and now have a new way of looking at it. And if you still haven't taken Ministry Safe training, not only is it a requirement, but I commend it to you just from a learning standpoint. It, for me, I worked in the corporate world for a long time. I took a lot of different kinds of harassment and behavior training. This was different from everything else I had taken, and it opened my eyes. And it's very well done. It's not too difficult to sit through. It's not too onerous, and so I highly commend it. If you haven't already, each congregation needs to give a list of all clergy, staff, and volunteers to Sheila as soon as possible. Now, that lots of requests for this have gone out, so I think we're at a very high percentage. I think we're at 85% on compliance. If you haven't, please get that to her as soon as possible. The template for that list is available on our website, and it allows Sheila to get those uploaded in a batch, so she's not having to type in each name and that sort of thing. So do use that template, and she will get your church loaded into the system. It triggers, once you give her the list and she gets it uploaded, you'll get an invitation with a link to the training, and everybody can take the training. So the coordinators will be able to see who has taken it and who hasn't taken it. And what's important about that is that the coordinator needs to say that volunteers, needs to be able to confirm that volunteers have taken that training before they're allowed to continue to work with children. In some cases, obviously, this is a new program, and so you'll have long-term volunteers in place who haven't taken the training. And there will be some time period where you're going to have to decide whether they're allowed to continue to work. But very soon, very quickly, we need to get to the point where people are not allowed to work with the children unless they've taken the training. Our target goal for that date is October 6th. And then, as Myron was pointing out, this is a one-time deal. We're getting it up and running. We'll get everybody to 100% compliance. But it's a maintenance issue. And so every time a volunteer is added, they need to go through this training. One question that came up is which volunteers need to take it. Any volunteer that is working with children at all needs to take it. It's critical. There's no question that they need to take it. But you may have volunteers who could just be in a position where they could come to work with children. You'll have to assess their exposure to children individually to determine whether they have to take it. We would encourage you to err on the side of having everyone take it. And part of that reason is not just to prevent them from being a problem, but because the people that take Ministry Safe training are your eyes in the congregation. You are training people to watch for this. You know, these predators hide, and they are in families, and they're in churches, and they know how to pass by without being caught. But the more eyes that you have, the more likely you are to catch a pattern of behavior. And so erring on the side of having all people take it is our recommendation. And that's why we at the diocese are covering the costs of the Ministry Safe training. We don't want there to be any barriers for you, especially in church plants, for encountering this problem. So, so please let us know if you have any barriers there. But our goal is to have a full compliance, 100% compliance with all congregations by Friday, October 6th. The other key area for ensuring that we understand the reality and the background of all of people in our midst is screening. Screening is a critical part and something that the church has identified for some time as a critical part of our hiring process. And so the diocese manages screening of clergy and licensed ministers. Everyone on this phone who came into the diocese has been through a screening process, although our procedures have changed over time. At this point, we'll be requiring background checks on a regular basis, and those are covered. We've got a method for covering those costs and making sure that they happen. So you don't have to worry about your clergy and licensed ministers, that there are processes in place, and that's not new. What's important in terms of this program is that you need to bring all of your staff and volunteers current on screening. So, you know, oftentimes we have staff members who come to work in one position, start working in another position. We have volunteers that come in and out, and it's easy to lose track of those sites, to lose track of those people and lose sight of their status. We need to be sure that every single staff member and volunteer has an updated national sex offender and criminal check every 2 years. This is outlined in the manual, and you'll get some more details on that process, but it's important that for all of our volunteers and staff members that you guys check their status on their background check, and if it's older than 2 years, they need a new one. It's something that has to happen regularly, because we may not know when things are reported or when incidents happen. The people that engage in these behaviors are good at hiding them, so we need to be checking regularly. There are also questions that are in the screening guide in your manual that are likely not currently gathered in your hiring process. Some of the larger churches have them, but most churches are not asking these questions. And these are questions about people's background in terms of things that they might have experienced, things that might have happened to them, which can be an indication of what things that they might do in the future. And so the questions in the screening guide are an important discussion and an important way to identify who could be at risk of becoming one of these people. So we need to have those forms completed if they haven't already been in your process. Take a look at those, and you will be able to understand what needs to happen. I'll give you an example of some of the questions. Has any member of your household been arrested for or convicted of any crime involving child abuse and or neglect, or had any such conviction expunged? Knowing that someone has an issue like this in their family may alert you to symptoms and to potential risks. And so it not only, hopefully in a form basis, it not only gives you an opportunity to identify a person who is at risk of perpetrating a crime, but it also gives you an opportunity to engage in a pastoral discussion with someone who might not otherwise open up to you about these things. So please take a look at those questions and make sure that everyone has completed them, even if they weren't part of their hiring process. These two important steps need to be completed for all staff and volunteers in mid-October. And the importance of that is that the rectors are going to complete their forms, their compliance forms, by the end of October, by October 31st. So this is one of the steps that they will need to sign off when they're done. Now, we talked about the importance of the rector, the coordinator, and the senior warden reviewing the child protection policy manual. Everyone on your team needs to read that manual. We've created our timeline so that you're reading it first, but everyone on your team has got to complete it. So what we would suggest is that you hold a group meeting and review the manual with all of your clergy, staff, and volunteers. This is an important opportunity to pull them together and open their eyes. They will likely confuse this with ministry safe training. I'll just warn you. A lot of the times when we're talking about these things, People will say, well, I've already had ministry safe training. Or even in the case of this meeting, we had people say, I don't need to be here today because I've been through ministry safe training. Screening is only one of the five topics that we, ministry safe training is only one of the five topics that we cover. So it's important that everyone be pulled together to read the manual. And I laugh a little bit when I say this because I have to tell you that St. James in San Jose was one of the first churches to implement Ministry Safe and to put some policies together locally. And I was one of the volunteers who was resistant. And just because I didn't recognize the importance at the time. So I think somewhere probably Pat Morris is smiling as she hears me say to everybody how important this is. All I can tell you is that my eyes have been opened and I understand it in a new way as a result of the training that I've had through Ministry Safe and from Myron. So I would encourage you guys to go through this, help people understand not just how to read it, but how to apply it and make sure that your team is having it as a group discussion. Now, each one of them has to sign at the back of the manual a form, the acknowledgement of receipt that we talked about at the beginning of the presentation. So every single member of your staff, your clergy, your volunteers need to sign that form and give those to you. And you guys need to maintain those statements indefinitely. We know that hopefully if an incident happens, people will report it quickly. We ask that, our training includes that, but in reality, sometimes children don't report these things quickly, or sometimes children don't even recognize what's happened and the importance of it until later. And so the report may come at a later date. At that time, it's important that you have the signed statements as records, and this is why we recommend that they're never destroyed or disposed of, that you keep them indefinitely. All right, so we talked through the making sure that your screening is up to speed, that you've gotten your background checks done, that you've gotten the questionnaires completed, you've gotten everybody up to ministry safe compliance, and you've made sure that everybody's been trained in the manual. At that point, once those three areas are covered, each congregation needs to return the certificate of compliance, which is in the back of the implementation manual. You'll see it there. It's a form that states, it's signed by both the rector and the senior warden. And I do know that some of the church plants don't have vestries. You don't have a senior warden in place yet. So in that case, your most senior lay leader would be the person that you would select, whoever that person is that's on your core group that's helping you to form, someone who's helps you in an executive capacity as a board member. That would be the person that you would have sign it. The two of you would sign the form, which states that you're responsible for ensuring that everyone on your team is complying and understands the program, and that you will continue to work through it in the year to come. In other words, you will continue to screen new hires. You will continue to assess your programs and facilities and processes to make sure that the ways that you're interacting with children and the ways that you're monitoring things comply with the program. So you'll continue that in the year ahead. We need to get those back from you by October 21st. So that means that by the third week in October, you guys have read, understood, and implemented the program. So two months from now, or I guess 6 weeks from now, that this program is in place. Our belief is that you guys are already started on this, so you're not starting from ground zero. And so hopefully that timing will work for you, because we'd like to celebrate full compliance at our convention on November 4th. And then going forward, we know that this, that many of you started this work for your congregations earlier. We will commit to that as well. We try to do it this time, but we we had much to learn and do to get ready. So going forward next year, anytime we update the manual or release new materials, that will happen in July each year, and then we'll ask for those compliance forms by the end of September, because most of you will be doing it ahead of back to school. So we'll try and give you a little more time going forward. I know we're getting close on the top of the hour, so I'll very quickly stop at this point to thank some special people. Sheila Jackson has absolutely been an incredible driver of this program, of making sure that the manuals were developed, that the all of the communication tools are in place, and that we were prepared to start with you today. And so she will also be doing, this is only the start for her, she will be the person that manages this program going forward. So we're very grateful for all the work that she's done. And Myron has been a champion of this for, I guess, almost 18 months now, and someone who's really a thought leader in this area. We're so blessed to have him working with us and guiding us in this way. And so my thanks for all of his passion on this topic. Trish Nelson, who has the wisdom of so much experience, both before her time at Christchurch Overland Park and there now. And she does a wonderful job of helping us to understand how to get things done practically. And then Andrea, Ryan, Bliss, and Nate, our communications team. As you guys see the website and you see the materials, I think you're going to be very impressed with the work that they've done. They are passionate about making things easy for you to understand and accessible to you, and I'm so grateful for them. And then we didn't have to start from scratch. We were able to leverage some of the work from the Diocese of the Mid-Atlantic in this area, who are also, they share our passion for this, and so it's wonderful not to be starting from scratch. Okay, so that was a lot. I know we covered a lot, and there are probably a lot of questions. Sheila, is there anything specifically that you're seeing from the group?
Not that I have an answer.
Okay, all right, good.
Yeah.
Myron, how about you? Is there anything that you would like us to underscore?
Some questions came in regarding whether members of the vestry should all take the training. And I can understand why there would be some hesitation if you don't see your role in church leadership as ever having direct contact with youth or children.
Yeah.
But there's a lot that we could say about the responsibilities on the vestry. We tend to all know what expectations within the church are for board members, but there's also state law that oversees what you're responsible for when you serve on a board. And one of those responsibilities is looking after safety generally in the organization on whose board you serve. And that includes, for the most part, things like physical safety. Are people going to be injured by stuff when they come on your premises? But churches are uniquely situated in having a lot of people of different age groups in one place at one time. That's not true of all nonprofit organizations. And one of your responsibilities as a vestry member is to make sure that it's a safe environment for everybody that comes in contact with your organization. And while you can delegate that responsibility to others, it needs to be an informed delegation. You've got to be able to know with confidence that when you delegate that, you're doing it to somebody who's got the capacity to fulfill the requirements. And it involves being able to monitor them. And there's no better way to assure that that's done than to actually have the training itself. I can certainly see examples where you could have less than everybody on the vestry have the training. But certainly from a litigation standpoint, it's helpful to have confidence in saying, we care about this so much, we require all of our senior leaders to go through the training. So I recommend it.
Yeah, that's great. And especially I would as a manager, I would recommend that, especially in the beginning, because when you're trying to drive a change in the DNA of your organization, the more people that you can bring along with you directly, the faster that will go. All right, what I have shared on screen is our website, so that you guys can take a look. We'll be sending that out in your follow-up email as well, but it's c4so.org/children. And what you'll find there is a letter from Bishop Todd, and he's very sorry he couldn't be here today. He's at the Bishop's Conclave up in Vancouver, and so he asks for your prayers in that conclave. But it would be, you'll find also on this website the Child Protection Policy Manual, as well as the Implementation Guide. You can download those from here. One of the things that we've included is a definition of child abuse. What is child abuse? And we want to make sure that you understand that it doesn't just include violence or sexual behavior, but also neglect. And making sure that that you're looking for all of the behaviors involved. For those of you who are trying to communicate this outward, that we've outlined the biblical foundation for this. There's some scriptural support for the work that we do there, and so that will help as you're training people in the manual and encouraging them to read it. And then some additional resources that that the communications team and Sheila have put together to help in your reading with this, especially as people get interested and aware. I got a question. What is the male-female breakdown of sex offenders, and is it legal to do different levels of background check according to gender? Myron, do you have a thought about that?
Could you repeat that question again?
Sorry, I know I slipped it in there fast.
I was reading the chat coming in.
Okay. Someone asked what the breakdown of male versus female offenders is and whether it's okay to have different levels of background checks by gender.
It is overwhelmingly dominated by male offenders, but that's not to discount the reality that there are female offenders whose patterns are very similar to those of males. So statistically, very much so. It's more of a male than female thing. But there are female offenders out there, and it manifests itself in the same way.
Yeah, and I suspect that that when we think male-female, a lot of times our heads are going to sexual abuse and maybe to violence, but the neglect area, you'll often find females convicted in that area. So Michael, technically from our policy perspective, there's no difference on who gets the background checked. It's one standard for all people. All right. Any other questions from the chat pod or? Okay, great. All right. Well, thank you for your time. I know as we were not attempting to train you on the manual today. So as I said, it's there on the website. All of the information is there. We'll be sending you a link to the website as well as a link to the recording as a follow-up. And that will be available to you guys at all time. And then your coordinators will have the also the Facebook group so that they can get together with their peers and solve some of the implementation problems. And then you guys just stay in touch. You know you can reach out to us anytime. Sheila would be the place to start on questions on this program. But Bishop Todd and Tony and Myron and I will all be her support team. And so just let us know if there's anything we can do to make it easier for you to implement this program locally. All right. Thank you, everyone. God bless you.